Okay. Let's see, you're Tiffany, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Mark you as here. So I'll come back to this later if some people come late. All right. Couple things to pay attention to that I didn't mention last time about the website, resources that will be good for you to look at on your own time. Right here at the top of the website, there are three links. The first two are really good. The third one is quite janky. It's a technical term, janky. No, it's a little bit... Well, a lot of the definitions on filmsound.org are dead links, but there still is a lot of good information there. But both the Columbia University Film Glossary and the examples from this website, College Film and Media Studies, are really great because we're not spending a lot of time going over the terms that are quite often used to talk about film and music and sound design in film. Quite often in the lecture, I will use these terms, but it's a really good idea to familiarize, especially if you haven't had any film theory classes before. For instance, last time I talked about certain camera techniques, certain editing techniques. I didn't get very in-depth about it, but for instance, the Columbia University Film Glossary website has hundreds of short clips of films that illustrate particular concepts or particular techniques, and it's actually really well done because they have various film critics or cinema studies professors that do voiceovers, and you can turn the voiceovers on and off. But as you see, for each lecture, I link the relevant terms here, so you can always, it should be pretty obvious now. We spent enough time on diegetic sound and non-diegetic sound that you shouldn't have too much trouble with that. But in case you didn't remember exactly, you can click on the link and you'll have, for instance, this excerpt that will analyze the scene, and there's some nice graphics and so on that go together with it. But that's also the case not just for the terms that I link, but if you go here, browse the terms, you'll see there are very many terms you can go through to get a little bit, somewhat fuller sense of some of the things that are happening. For instance, one of the things that today I will end up talking about, which I won't spend very much time on, but if you look at the topics that we have today, two of the terms that I'm going to be discussing are montage and mise-en-scene. And you can see many different examples on these websites of films that do interesting things with the various techniques. For right now, I'm going to spend more time on montage as a technique, but I'll just give you a very brief description of what mise-en-scene refers to. In some sense, it's something that requires less of a definition than montage. But I'll start with montage. Montage basically means the way that the film is edited. So it actually comes from the word to mount, montage. It means like you cut the film and then you mount it together, you put it in order. So whenever you see the cutting, for instance, in, what was the movie? The Bourne Ultimatum from yesterday. One of the things I mentioned, film being quite often very discontinuous, means that usually you have a succession of shots, each of which usually only lasts a few seconds at a time. You have other directorial styles. So, for instance, how many people saw the new Blade Runner movie? Nobody saw the new Blade Runner movie? Oh, really? Not even you?
No.
All right, well, I was going to use that as a launching off point to talk about a director who's even more obscure than the director of that movie. A director who was thoroughly imitated in the new Blade Runner movie, Andrei Tarkovsky. The point being that there are plenty of films where you have very slow shots, and quite often the rate at which which film is cut at creates, you know, either a sense of perhaps action or tension. So, for instance, in Born on Tomato, one of the reasons that that scene is so tense is that the camera is constantly, or the film is constantly shifting from shot to shot to shot to shot to shot. If you wanted to create a sense of more sort of expansive, an expansive world or an expansive feeling, then you might have longer, durationally longer shots. The point is that montage just refers to the act of cutting from shot to shot and putting them together into an order. Now, there are all sorts of interesting aesthetic implications of that, aesthetic, philosophical, political, and other implications of the way that montage functions and the way that we experience it psychologically. But for now, just remember that montage means the idea of cutting, moving from shot to shot. Mise-en-scène is the other basic visual component. Well, I suppose there are sort of three visual components here. We've got the cutting, you've got the actual camera work, and then you have what the camera is filming. Right? So that seems pretty straightforward. What the camera is filming is basically what the mise-en-scène is referring to. Mise-en-scène literally means the setting of the scene. And it can, the thing is, it can actually mean very much more than either the cinematography, the camera work, or the cutting, the montage, the film editing, because it includes basically everything that you see in an image, including not just the actors, but the wardrobes, the perhaps the set design, if it's on a set. If not on a set, then it might be some natural location or something like that. It also includes the lighting, it includes the color scheme, includes everything that is included within the image that is separate from the motion of the camera or the particular angle of the camera or the cutting of the film. Okay, so basically the objects that the camera is filming is what is referred to by the term mise-en-scène. Okay, so I'll probably use that now and then. And again, you can go online and look for some interesting discussion of this on those websites that I pointed your attention to. So that's one thing to keep in mind. And here down at the bottom of today's lecture, you might go online and look at montage, mise-en-scène, and continuity editing, because those are each going to be important. The other thing to mention, I don't know, I mean, it's on the syllabus, so you should be, if you're going to the syllabus, as you should be, you will have seen that there's a reading assignment. When I call it a reading assignment, it doesn't mean you have to turn it in, but you should do the reading before the lectures. It turns out, actually, this is from last year, so you have to subtract one day from each date here. So, for instance, today it would have been good to read the two pages from Here in the Movies. It's not that important because I'm going to cover most of this in the lecture, and we looked at some of these things last time as well. But for Thursday, I would like you to have read basically everything else. So there's, within this reading, there are a bunch of little excerpts. So make sure you do the reading on time. Both the reading from Theodor Adorno and Hans Eisler and Sergei Eisenstein and some other directors, the statement on sound. And then there are some questions about the movie we're going to watch tomorrow, Alexander Nevsky. So be aware that this material is here, and you should have read through everything before the lecture. All right. Yes, question?
Are the readings that that page refers to posted on the syllabus? Or
well,
yeah, just keep...
See, it says there are 24 pages, so you just keep scrolling.
Oh.
Many, many. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So each of the reading assignments are compiled like this, and there are some prompt questions at the beginning of each reading assignment. Okay? Good. So make sure to do the reading. All right. So what I would like to do now, continue some analyses of various scenes. Today what we're going to do is an example of the masking assignment that I told you about yesterday. What I would like to do is watch a couple scenes from a few different movies, We'll watch two different scenes. One we'll watch with just the images and no sound before watching it together with the sound, and then we'll do the opposite. We'll watch a scene from a movie. Well, we won't watch it. We'll listen to a scene from a movie in darkness, and then watch it together with the sounds and see what sorts of changes in our experience of the scene are brought out by the combination of sounds and images. And again, it's going to be useful for you to think about some of the things that we talked about last time, some of the concepts, including what is the sound that you're hearing? So remember the three dimensions of the soundtrack: there's the dialogue, the sound design, and the music. And then you have, within the relationship between the sound and the images, you have the notion of diegetic sound and diegetic music, non-diegetic sound or music. You have empathetic use of sound and music, and empathetic sound. One further thing which is slightly different is the notion of whether the sound is on screen or off screen. So, for instance, with diegetic music could be off screen. What would be an example of off screen diegetic sound or music? Think about what diegetic sound is. What was diegetic sound again?
It's in the storage space.
Right, it's in the storage space. So what would be an example of off-screen diegetic sound or music?
If you have a
scene,
or you mean like a specific
example? No, I don't have to be a specific example.
If you have a scene where you're cutting back and forth between two locations and one of them has music playing in the scene, you can continue to hear it?
Well, that's actually very interesting. That's a little bit more complex, because if it's two different locations, then at the moment that you're, the shot is at the other location, there's a question about whether it would be diegetic, because here's a more simple example. Basically, on that account, if you had a shot of somebody in a cafe and there's a band playing, and then he's thinking about going to the beach, and you have a shot of the beach, and the music's still playing, well, the music's not at the beach, right? So then is it diegetic? It's a little bit unclear. I guess it sort of is, because the implication maybe is that the character's thinking about the beach, but it's a more straightforward example. For instance, there's a character who's listening to the radio and is responding to what's on the radio, but you just don't see the radio. But you know the radio is in space, right? It's the sound's off stage, or off screen, rather. And it's also diegetic. On screen diegetic sound, well, that's pretty obvious. You see the musicians playing the music, for instance. Offstage non-diegetic sound, non-diegetic music, makes plenty of sense, right? That's usually the situation. If you, like in the Jason Bourne excerpt last time, we don't actually think that there's a, you know, a string orchestra playing at the train station. It's offstage, and it's also, I'm sorry, I keep saying offstage. It's off-screen and also non-diegetic. Now here's the tricky one. Can you think of what it would mean to have on-screen, non-diegetic music? Or non-diegetic sound, at least, maybe not music. What would that mean? Is that even possible? On-screen, but non-diegetic. I can only think of one example. I actually kind of mentioned it last time. And it's not exactly music. It's a sort of sound design element. But yeah, did you?
Well, there's an example I can think of that is maybe sort of accidental. In The Gadfly, which Shostakovich scored, there's a moment where there's an organ grinder on screen, and they couldn't find a working organ grinder, so he composed a little wind octet for it, and that's what you hear.
Right.
But that's sort of accidental. But
yeah, that's sort of interesting. So imagine that you have a film soundtrack that's playing along, and let's say that there's like a violin solo, and the camera is like panning across a crowded city square or something, and in the corner somewhere there's a violinist. He might even actually be playing the same music. That's a kind of interesting question, whether that would be non-diegetic and on-screen. But there's something even more common than that. I was referring to The Lord of the Rings the other day, and the use of reverb, the way that reverb quite often appears and is used in films to create a sort of otherworldliness or give a sort of gravitas to either music or language. So I gave a hypothetical example of being in a car talking to my girlfriend who's breaking up with me, and I say, but I love you, and when I say, but I love you, suddenly my voice has all this reverb on it. It'd be a horrible example. But think about this for a second. It's on screen, but it's also in a sense non-diegetic because the reverb itself is not actually in the space of the story. Right? It's not, in a way, the reverb, the processing of the sound, post-production processing of the sound to give it this sort of sense of grandiosity, has a narrative function much in the way that if there were a soundtrack playing really serious music would have a sort of gravity. And from that point of view, it's basically not part of the story space, and yet at the same time, it's sort of, I mean, you see me saying the words, so the words are on screen, and yet at the same time, some component of the sound of the words, namely the reverb, would be off screen. Now, I gave a very cheesy example, right? But you do see that quite often in film that there will be sounds that, for instance, when the, another example of this perhaps is almost sort of like with the helicopters in Apocalypse Now last time, right? I mean, you do see them press play, and but at a certain point, the music, even though we know that the characters are hearing it because they're playing the tapes, it sort of transmogrifies into this non-diegetic thing, where it's just, and we know that because it's just too loud relative to the position of the helicopters. But technically, it's still on screen, right? It's just that the loudness, the fact that the sound designer is using production techniques to give a sort of emphasis to the music that is not actually literally part of the story, that has this narrative function, much in the way that if it were really a newly composed film score would have. That might also be an example of on-screen, non-diegetic use of music or sound design. So it actually gets quite complex when you start to think of all the various combinations and ways that a single sound or single piece of music might exist in multiple, in a sense, in multiple dimensions at the same time. So those are some of the things to think about when we do this masking exercise. You know, all of those various questions, diegetic, non-diegetic, empathetic, anempathetic. What is music? What is noise and sound design, sound effects? And what is dialogue, perhaps? Another thing to think about is if you start just, for instance, with the sounds and not watching the images, how important does it, how shall I say this, how easy is it to tell what the sounds are? That is to say, you know, sometimes the sound might very obviously be, oh, I don't know, an airplane taking off or something, and you don't have to see the movie, you hear the airplane, or you hear a piano, or something that's extremely obvious where you know what it is. And even more often than that, probably, you'll hear a bunch of sounds where it's not really clear what the cause of the sound. So we had an example of that with Jason Bourne yesterday, where in the fight scene, there are these sounds that, in a sense, they're not exactly music. They just sort of sound like sort of background ambiance, but when you really listen to what the sound is, you know, it sounds like a helicopter, for instance, or a machine gun or something, but it's clearly not, because that has nothing to do with the scene. That's a situation in which the cause of the sound is basically underdetermined, where the sound now is no longer, its identity is no longer about making us aware of, say, an airplane in the story, but rather the sound is being much more, being used much more abstractly and, in a sense, much more musically from that point of view. So those are some of the things to think about. All right, so let's start with the masking exercises, so you can get a sense of the sorts of things I'm going to ask you to send to me. Let's see, what am I doing here? I just got it a second ago. Am I on the right? Oh, there it is. Okay. All right. This is a scene from Full Metal Jacket. Stanley Kubrick film. Let me turn off the lights here. Okay, so we're going to watch this. We're going to watch this without any sound. And I want you to pay attention to the mise-en-scene, which will include the color schemes, the wardrobes, you know, all the various things that are being filmed, even the characters' faces, perhaps. I want you to pay attention to the editing techniques, the montage techniques. Pay attention to the other visual elements, the rhythm, the pacing, etc., some of the same sorts of things we looked at last time. And then I want you to perhaps try to think about what the general mood of the scene is, what perhaps, if any meaning at all, is trying to be conveyed with the images, what is the meaning that's trying to be conveyed, and probably we'll have a few different interpretations of that. And for each of those questions, it's not enough to just say what is the meaning or what is the mood, but how is that mood, how is that meaning actually created? What are the techniques involved that seem to create our experience? Okay, so sound is off, and I think that it should start in the right place. Nope, not. Okay, let's try that again. Here we go. Okay. What? No, this is... I guess I went back too far. Just a second. Let me put you in total darkness for a second so I can set it up in the right place. Okay, good. Now we're ready. Okay. That's a good place to stop for now. All right. So let's get into those questions. And I finally have your names in my random list generator, so we'll randomly call on people unless we have some volunteers, but I'm really happy to take volunteers first. Let's think about some of those questions. The pacing, the camera work, the mise-en-scene, the color, the lighting. What sort of general mood seems to be created here, and how? And does it seem to have any particular meaning? Let me see. Emma.
The pacing, I'd say this is kind of reminiscent of just like any war movie.
Okay, well, let's not compare it right now to, let's actually try to describe it just positively, like, that is to say, what do you actually see? You know, does it seem, for instance, it's not very helpful to say it seems like a bunch of other war movies, although you could contrast it, perhaps, to other movies. I mean, you could contrast it, perhaps, to the Jason Bourne movie that we watched yesterday, the scene. In which ways might it be different? Say the editing, the camera work. Does anybody remember the scene? Yeah.
How I saw it was that there was like, it's sort of like there's a filter over it that makes it sort of like gloomy. It's like gray, like the smoke.
Oh, so you mean the colors are all kind of drab?
Yeah, yeah. It's like drowned.
Right, it's that kind of khaki green. It doesn't help that I'm playing this from my computer that turns everything into a sort of dingy yellow. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Even if we were watching this on, pristine film, you'd still notice that it's not exactly a very colorful scene. There's basically like one color, which is this kind of drab green in slightly different shades.
Gray.
And gray and cloudy sky, or smoke.
Gray. Yep.
Right. All the foliage is the same color, obviously, as the camouflage and so on. So, so that's definitely true. And that's an important element of the mise-en-scène. Irene.
The camera, the shot was a very long shot. The end part was pretty long.
Which shot was long?
The end part is it's just panning over a lot of things.
Oh right, yeah. So some of the shots are reasonably long. I mean, they're not extremely long.
But I mean, compared to the Jason Bourne.
Yeah, sure.
That we saw the other day.
Right.
Yeah. Which I think it kind of moves it also kind of into the gloomier type of thing. It's not as fast paced as what's happening.
Well, there's certainly less motion.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, first of all, I mean, most of the motion is way back in the background. You see the flames and so on. They're moving a little bit. But there's not as much motion even in the mise-en-scène. Even just, you remember the train station, people moving all around, all over the place. There's a lot of life activity, this sort of thing. Here, it's pretty much devoid of motion except for one or two figures here or there. What about the camera? Does the camera move very much compared to, say, the action sequence last time? No. Right? You do have a pan, but it's a very continuous, fluid pan that follows this camera crew. And for the rest of the time, it's just a static camera. You have some shots. What about the rate of, you kind of brought this up, it doesn't seem like there's the cutting is as rapid as in a Jason Bourne movie. Right, so these are all important elements. And it seems like one idea that has been brought up is that there's a sort of gloominess, perhaps, that is articulated by the slow, lack of motion, lack of color. It doesn't seem to be a very vital scene, vital in the sense of full of life. It seems full of death, but not in the way that the Apocalypse Now seems full of death, death from above sort of thing. This is just sort of existential dread. Right? What about, does it seem to have any meaning of any sort? This is not, you can answer in the affirmative or the negative. I don't know that it necessarily does have any meaning, but it might be interesting if any of you felt very strongly that it seemed to be communicating one thing or another. Did anybody have any sense of that?
Yeah. How I just looked at it, the lack of action and just how gloomy it is. It looks like it just gives. I guess it's trying to display the dread and the lifelessness, the bore. It's just
Just invisible all the time. I have one question about that, of course. And I'll get to you in a second, Jeff. How many people? I made sort of a mistake when I loaded this clip up because the first image was the camera crew. But when you saw the guys crouching moving along, how many people assumed at first that it was just soldiers jimmying about in their trenches or whatever? And how obvious was it at first that it was a camera crew? I think it's actually kind of set up as a joke in a way. You see these guys crouching, but then it turns out that it's NBC News or whatever, doing a special exclusive report from the front or whatever. Which I think in a way has a sort of absurdity to it, right? It's sort of a joke, which we can take one way or another, perhaps. I mean, there might be a place that we start to discern some sort of meaning right? That, in a sense, the fact that you, at first you see these guys crouching, you think they're just trying to, like, do their jobs and stay alive. But then it turns out that it's a camera crew that probably from, you know, either making a documentary or a camera crew from the news, with perhaps lofty ideals of, you know, giving you the straight story from the front lines. But at the same time, I don't think any of us miss that there seems to be this sense that the camera crew is not actually part, I mean, they're not soldiers, and it seems like, in a sense, they sort of see the war zone that they're in as an object for possible entertainment. That is to say, that they're filming it, they're going to, you know, broadcast it and so on. There seems to be perhaps a sort of strange sense that that there's a sort of entertainment value to this scene in a way.
It's really interesting too, because the main character that they're following here is also a journalist, but he's like God's son, and he's participating in the battles.
The main character,
I just watched it last week.
Yeah, oh really, it's been a while. Thank you. I couldn't remember if he was a journalist or not.
Yeah, he's a journalist.
Right.
And he's now embedded with this crew, and so when these guys show up, it's like,
that's right, yeah.
They're just not participating at all. They're just.
Right, yeah.
And he's in the thick of it with everybody else.
And it definitely does seem like there's a rift in a way, right, between the scene and the scene that's being filmed. And it's even more, I think it's even more, the absurdity is putting to even stronger relief when you get the frontal shot of the camera crew and you just see them filming nothing. I guess they're filming us, perhaps, something like that. But there's something a little bit strange about that as well. Perhaps. Jeff, did you want to comment on anything?
Yeah, to add on to that, they're using a landscape shot instead of a portrait one to show a little more like the panoramic view. Basically, maybe like if Sheldon displayed it like this, emotion minded.
Yeah, that is an interesting point. So basically, what is your this is not something we mentioned, there's a lot of use of wide angle lenses. And you have a lot of depth of field. So these images, almost all of them, you see very, very far away. The very first image, I mean, you know, there are scenes or shots in between where it's a close-up and sort of thing, but like the very beginning where you see the guy shooting at the enemy soldiers, that's also very far away. And it does give a sort of sense of spaciousness, perhaps, which seems appropriate for the slowness of some of the other elements, the editing techniques and so on. Certainly doesn't seem as cramped as the scene from the Born Ultimatum, which did have a few wide angle shots, but for the most part, there were a lot of close-ups of the characters all the time. And that gives a sort of cramped, tense feeling in the way that a wide angle shot feels a little bit more spacious. Those narrow angle shots will often feel a little bit more perhaps cramped or tense. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it's also like the camera is reflective of how combat is.
Mm-hmm.
So like in Born Ultimatum, like in that scene,
mm-hmm.
It's close quarters combat.
Mm-hmm.
So there's
mm-hmm.
and this is like they're using tanks to shell the city from afar.
Right. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting point. And that's very interesting actually because. The sense of the Born Ultimatum is that the cam, you know, it's supposed to seem like a documentary, this documentary style with the handheld camera and the zooming, and the counterpoint between zooming and placing the shot, remember, which gives it a very strong sense of visceralness. There's something very visceral about the filmmaking there, whereas this feels very disembodied in a way. It's very distant from the action, which might also be something that might have a sort of semantic level, a level of meaning where it sort of seems to be communicating some specific meaning. Yeah.
Yeah, it almost feels like a survey of what's happening, you know? Like
yeah.
Just kind of, detached from it.
Yeah. So I guess, Penny, since you're just watching, you probably know what the sound design is. Here, but for everybody else, has anybody else ever seen this movie? A few people? Yeah. The rest of you, what do you think some appropriate sound design choices, music design choices might be? What do you think you would do if you were the composer, sound designer, I suppose director, making these sorts of choices? What sorts of things would you do? Yeah.
I probably wouldn't include like music. Uh-huh. I'd pretty much have like a more natural,
more realistic.
Yeah, because considering you're kind of in a way doing it from the perspective of the cameraman, mm-hmm. they're carrying a mic around, mm-hmm. you're probably going to want that to reflect like what's actually going on.
Yeah. Well, we go back to yesterday where Alec was talking about how music seems to have this sanitizing function. When you see violence, but there's like a string orchestra playing, that there seems to be this sort of aestheticizing or sanitizing element in the music. It could be the case that if there were like, we were talking about this with Ride of the Valkyries and the Helicopters, that if there were a big lush orchestral score going on here, it would in a way seem to make it way more beautiful than it's supposed to be. That there's something supposed to be something ugly about this, but very bleakly ugly, right? That is to say, there's something ugly about the helicopters blowing up civilians or whatever yesterday. But at the same time, at least my feeling there is, it makes me morally uneasy, and yet at the same time, it's like so exciting. You know, there's something beautiful about the carnage, and I don't think that that's the idea here. Conversely, it's possible that music might be able to create a sort of sense of aestheticized distance in the way that most of this is carried out with long shots, wide-angle shots, you know, that it might be possible to have, if you chose the right music, something that would also convey that sort of detachment from the action of the battlefield. Perhaps that might be something. But in either case, so no music or sort of this very ethereal kind of, you know, static sort of music, maybe sort of bleak sound of music, perhaps. What else? Any other thoughts on perhaps the sound design? So it seems like most of us, or at least Daniel, would have all sound design and no music. Anybody else have? Let me take one more victim, Cindy. What do you think you would do here?
I agree with that. I think there's a lot of rubble and ground. I would have loved to hear the steps of the cameraman as they
uh-huh.
walk past that really long shot. I think in the very beginning of the clip that you showed us, where that was like that one single soldier, and we saw the view from like the back of his head
uh-huh.
when he shot those soldiers in like the background, and he kind of looked kind of happy about it, and he kind of, it's like this weird range of emotions that kind of cross his face as he, I guess it was like pride or something where he killed all those people. And he kind of looks more sad towards the end. I would have loved to see some music there that kind of matched the mood that he was
making. Well, that would be really tricky to do as a composer, right? Because he cycles through these emotions so rapidly. What you would have to do is write a piece of music that conveyed all those emotions at the same time. Because if it were like, it'd be ridiculous. So that would actually be very tricky. You'd have to write or find a piece of music that conveyed happiness and bleakness at the same time. And there is music that does that, perhaps. It might be possible. But then the question is, we only see him go through those emotions over the span of probably 10 seconds at the most. You know, so you'd have 10 seconds of music, perhaps. Maybe it'd be a little bit difficult to figure out a good way to do that. I'm not saying that that's a bad idea. It's just a little, you know, think about what it would actually mean if we tried to do that. But it is interesting that he starts off sort of fearful, perhaps, and then excited, and then proud, and then kind of adopts this, 100-yard stare into the abyss. Good. So now let's watch it with the sound on, and I want you to pay attention to the way that your experience of the scene is changed once we have sound happening. For some reason, my computer is turned black. The screen is black. Good, there we go. Okay. So basically, same sorts of questions as before, but now we're adding music to it. And so the question is, does the music reinforce the things that you thought were communicated by the visuals? Or does it perhaps, is it in tension with the visuals in some way? And is there any new additional information that's conveyed by the sound or the music, if there is any? And also then, we'll want to think about it in a way sort of more formally or more abstractly. How does the rhythm of the images match or create a sort of tension with the rhythm of the music? Here we go. And I need to make sure that I've plugged in my sound. Yeah, it should work now. Let's see. No, why does it keep going to this thing? All right, let's try this again. And I didn't have sound for some reason. Probably I need to turn that on. Okay, let's try this again. Cindy was right, but I'll say why I think she was right after I hear what you guys think. How did the music and sound design affect your experience of the scene? Did it change anything?
Made it feel faster.
Made it feel faster? Yeah, certainly, right? Now there's a lot of motion going on. Mm-hmm. What else? Yeah, that's something you see happen quite often when you have music that has a very strong beat. Basically, if you really look at what's happening, there's a lot of motion. Even if you, you know, it might even just be like, you know, the elbow of one of the people in the camera crew is moving a little bit, and you didn't notice it before, but now that there's a regular beat, the images will sort of suddenly magnetize into the beat, and you'll find some motion in the scene that kind of fits the beat. That happens all the time. And so that's another interesting element. Yeah.
I thought it was interesting how whenever, you know, the song kind of went down, whatever the tank went off, and then you heard like this hang tank over
yeah,
it.
Right. That's right. So you hear a little bit of sound design, although not very much.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Much less than most of us probably expected. In fact, almost none, except for the really loud sounds, the tank explosion, that sort of thing.
But I think that kind of like brought it back into the. Into like the imagery of what's on it, and then it kind of goes back into the more ridiculous type of sound.
Yeah.
It's kind of like very anti. It's like the music makes it seem happy-go-lucky in a way, which is like very, very opposite of what we were talking about with the gloom and the very, very like. Like single colored, like imagery.
Yeah.
It's like, it sort of makes it, it's like, oh yeah, this is just four. Like, that's
a few. Now, the reason that I thought Cindy was onto something was because what I took her to mean is that, you know, some kind of music that kind of matches that range of emotions. And do you remember what I said was that, well, you have to find a piece of music that is simultaneously happy and bleak. And I think that this piece of music fits the bill because it's kind of happy in a way. I mean, it's obviously very rhythmic and stuff, but it's so utterly insipid. It's so, in a way, there's something so, I suppose, banal or even kind of, you know, obscenely stupid about the song that it kind of fits the bleakness. Like, can you imagine, what would you think about a friend of yours, especially in the 60s when this song was popular? This movie's from the 80s, but the song was written in the late 60s. Who thought that that was the pinnacle of art. If you had a friend who thought, yeah, I love art. You know that song, Bird is the Word? Wouldn't you have a sort of sense that there's something very vapid and vacant about that person? Right? That there's something very bleak, in a way, about how completely disposable a commodity that song is. So there's something, and that's true of most pop music. I mean, not all pop music, certainly, but the majority of pop music that gets produced, you know, you hear it for a month or two, you know, you think about, like, what's that woman's name? Megan Trainor. It's all about the bass. That's basically the same sort of song as this, right? You could actually throw in, it's all about the bass here. And you get the same sort of effect, that it's like, yeah, it's very rhythmic, it seems like it's full of life, but there's something very inhuman about it. It's inhuman because it's so cliché, it has nothing of the actual depth of human emotion in it, right? And at the same time, it's happy. So there's this sort of strange interplay between happiness and bleakness already in the song, perhaps. I mean, it's not necessarily immediately expressed by the song. The bleakness is sort of a function of how stupid the song is. But at the same time, it does perhaps kind of speak to that ambiguity, the emotive ambiguity of the scene, you know, in an interesting way. How many of you could understand the words of the song? Could you hear the word bird at all? No? Because whenever I see this scene, suddenly I notice all these bird images in the scene. Beyond the helicopter, the guy, the assistant, or I don't know what the job is called, but the guy who, like, helps land the helicopter is, like, doing it. And then, like, when the camera crew's tracking, they look kind of like some weird bird, like, you know, doing a bird walk or something.
The opening shot, too, is, like, a little...
Yeah, right. You know what I mean? Right, exactly. So, it's sort of interesting the way that the sound here changes our experience of the scene. Did you want to say something, Emma?
No, I'm just saying.
Oh, okay. Just scratching your head. All right. Let's now do the opposite. We'll listen without viewing and see what comes of that. So let me turn off the screen. All right, good. Get my clip ready here. Okay, this will take about 5 seconds here. I'll just start it here. Oops, I'll start it here. So, what I'd like you to do is pay attention now to the sounds and try to think about which sounds are diegetic, non-diegetic, etc., all those various categories that we came up with. I'd like you to think about which sounds now are sound effects and which are music. This might be a little bit ambiguous. It might even be the first time. This is actually a clip that a student brought in a couple years ago that I liked quite a lot. Actually, when I heard this, part of it was a little bit ambiguous about what was music, sound design, or dialogue. There was actually a moment where it's a little unclear if there's a human voice involved or not. And I suppose that's basically it. You know, you might think about what sorts of, if you hear sound effects rather than music, you might try to think about what sort of space this is in, what seems to be communicated just with the sounds. All right. So hopefully all will go well when I play this. So let's go back to the questions that are raised. Maybe we'll start with the three aspects of the soundtrack, the music, the sound effects, and the dialogue. And we'll try to describe all the various sounds that we heard. So you heard piano. What else was the sound? Chicken, obviously. What else? Actually, the chicken's not so obvious, I have to say. This is often corroborated by other people, so it's not just me. But the first time I heard it, I kind of thought that it was some bizarrely deformed child laughing. As a very beginning, just for like the first 3 seconds or so. Yeah, and then it becomes clear that it's a chicken. But it's not that obvious immediately. See, pigs and or deformed children or other sorts of gremlins. What else did you hear? There are a lot of other sounds happening.
Things falling.
Things falling. So you heard crashes of some sort.
Yeah, kind of sounded like, you know, a big pile of stuff fell over.
Yeah.
Is a car engine on the background?
Okay, can you describe it in terms of what it sounded like, other than saying it's a car, like what? Was it a repetitive sound?
Yeah,
was
repetitive.
It a high sound, a low sound?
Low sound, repetitive sound.
A repetitive low sound.
Background does for a continuous.
Can you sing it?
No.
Well, the question was, can you sing it? Not, do you feel ashamed?
I don't know how to make that sound.
You mean something like that, or something else?
Maybe something like that.
Okay. Well, there were low sounds.
Yeah, I was thinking it more as like a continuous, like, like it's like background of the, it's like the base of whatever the music is.
So is it music or is it sound design? Because if it's a car, then it might have something to do with the scene, if it's like an engine perhaps. If it's not an engine, then maybe it's music. One way of getting at this question is, does anybody have a sense of what space this scene seems to be happening in?
I was assuming the chickens were diegetic, so that it was in some sort of a barnyard, but it seems like it's inside, so maybe a barn.
Wouldn't it be great if they were not diegetic?
Yeah, it would be.
Right, we got that. But there are a lot of sounds that aren't immediately, that don't immediately evoke a barnyard. There's a very mechanical sound.
It sounded like it was inside, so I was assuming it was in a barn or like a, you know, chicken house.
So how did you know it sounded like it was inside?
Just the kind of echoey sound, you know, you can hear the sound coming back off of the walls and see what those.
So there seems to be more ambiance, more sort of like a room echo or something like that, perhaps. Now, there the question is that the music or is it the space? Because that might be a little bit unclear. I think that a lot of the sounds are like really echoey. You know, like and it's also interesting if you notice very closely how much echo was on the chicken. Well, none actually. There are a bunch of sounds, Moog sounds, crash sounds, these sorts of things that are like gigantic and echoey. And at the same time, if it's a single space, it couldn't be the case that it's a big room because the chicken, for instance, doesn't sound like it's in a cavern, right?
Yeah, it feels claustrophobic with the chicken. Like you're in a small room with a large chicken.
Yeah,
it's like right in front and center of the mix.
Yeah. So, what other? There's another sound that's there that nobody's mentioned yet.
Is there a sound of the door opening when she's first calling for her?
There's a sound of the door. Yeah.
Or it's loud.
Yeah, there's a creaky kind of. It's the door or some kind of piece of wood or something like that. But there's a sound that's mentioned, which is actually there almost all the time. And maybe that's why people haven't noticed it, because it's kind of
the rain or the thunder sheets?
Well, there's a sound that sounds kind of like mechanical rain, perhaps.
Yeah.
Or it sounds maybe like, you know, old-timey movie projector or something.
Yeah, it's like white, some sort of white noise sort of sound. But not rain, like it's too heavy for rain.
Well, it's also articulated. It's not shh, it's like cluck, 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 or like that kind of thing. Yeah, you hear that.
But like layers of that.
Yeah. Good. So how much of that do you think is sound design? How much do you think is non-diegetic music? Because, the crashes and the low sounds might or might not be. There's the sound of the piano, which Penny mentioned, which is sort of interesting. Is the piano... The way that she described it was the piano falling over, which would maybe make us think that it's part of the scene, not music. But then... that's a question that we might have when we watch the scene. Okay, so let's watch the scene now and see what changes in our experience of it with the visuals. All right. Oh, sorry, I forgot to turn on the screen. There we go. Stop before anything too horribly gruesome happens. But I think that there's some really interesting stuff happening here, mostly as regards the ambiguity between sound effects and music. So, what about the piano sounds, the kind of crashy piano sounds and thunder sheety metallic sounds? How much of that seemed, I mean, originally we probably thought that the sound of metal was probably, maybe it was like a, you know, when I first heard it, I thought it sounded like it was some kind of factory or something. It sounded like a factory. Because you've got the sound of the mill or whatever it is You've got the thunder sheets of metal going on. Of course, there is actually a moment when she first falls that somebody strums the high piano strings, this kind of sound, which is from the piano. But clearly, that's non-diegetic. It's part of the musical soundtrack. What about that mill sound, that sort of mechanical sound? Was it diegetic or non-diegetic? No, and did you notice, for a while the sound cuts out. Mm-hmm. I guess full disclosure, I will say the beginning of this scene, they're walking through this abandoned old mill house, and you hear that sound as soon as the scene starts, that they're outside, they're walking in. And so the implication is that it is probably part of the ambiance of the house, the mill or whatever. But when she starts walking in, it's very quiet. There is a very clear moment, though, when it starts up again, and it's really present. In the scene. Does anybody remember what image it was synchronized with?
The bone.
Yeah, it's the bone.
And that's actually what it is, like a bone rattle that you're hearing, I think.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's a bone rattle. I think it is supposed to be a mill. Because at the beginning of the scene, they walk in and you hear that. There's no music or anything, you know. But what is interesting is that it's this moment, maybe it is non-diegetic, who knows? Because, you know, I don't think you ever actually see the mill. It's been a while since I've seen this movie, but it could be non-diegetic. But what's really interesting about it is that it's clearly some kind of mechanical noise, but doesn't it have this wonderful sort of strange bony association? There's something very bony and skeletal about the sound, but also mechanical at the same time. And so whether or not I think it is actually a diegetic sound effect. It's part of the ambiance of the space, but it goes away for a moment, and then it comes back as a non-diegetic sound, where it's now together with the bone, really presently, create this very sort of dry, brittle, mysterious, but also mechanical sort of sound. I guess, in a way, if you're going to talk about this in terms of musical development, it's sort of like a variation on the chainsaw. This mechanical sound of death, I suppose. Perhaps. What about? I love the way that the scene is filmed when she first enters the room, and she looks really horrified. And there's a shot reverse shot, which is a typical sort of thing that you get where, whenever you see a conversation film, you'll have a character speaking, and their line of sight will then be matched with the next shot. So, like, for instance, if there's a main character and they're looking at something, there's an example of this in the Jason Bourne film where Jason Bourne looks, you see him turn his head, and then the next shot is the camera panning really rapidly, and the thing that he's looking at is a security camera, and if you just, like, go up to the screen and, like, draw a line, you'll see that the position of his eyes in the shot are in a direct line to the camera, and that's just described as matching the line of sight in shot reverse shot situations. And the same thing happens here, where she like looks up and then you see the chicken at the top of the frame. It's really wonderful because it's like this really mysterious, horrifying, kind of gruesome seeming scene, but there's this ridiculous moment where it seems like the thing that she's terrified of is the chicken. But then it turns out that she wasn't actually looking at the chicken, she's looking at all the bone sculptures. So.
It's amazing how the chicken kind of was so prevalent when we were just listening to the sound, but then when you have the images, it kind of just fades. But maybe you listen to it for a different amount of time, but it's still.
It was almost exactly the same amount of time. We watched it about 10 seconds less, perhaps, or so, but you know. Pretty much the same amount of time. But you're absolutely right. For one, now there's a lot more to pay attention to, so your attention is divided. But it also seems like the chicken, we quickly realize, is irrelevant to the scene, at least understood in very literal terms. By literal, I mean that the character has certain interests, namely she wants to find Kirk and presumably survive, right? And the bones and the weird room seem to be a threat to her interests. The chicken doesn't seem to be relevant to her interests. That's what I mean when I say it seems irrelevant on a literal level. However, on an emotional level, I don't think it's the case that the chicken is irrelevant. I think that the chicken actually makes it seem a lot creepier than it would be. Well, if it doesn't make it creepier, it certainly makes it seem more inscrutable. It makes it a lot harder to understand the scene with all the bones and the abject horror in her face and the darkness with this completely absurd sort of non-sequitur chicken whose voice at a certain point is the loudest thing that you hear. You know, it's sort of strange moment of uncertainty that the chicken brings about. It's sort of like, what? It's just really kind of confusing. But it's confusing in a way that potentially, maybe it's not done that well. Maybe some of you don't feel that it raises the tension or the mystery particularly well. But I think that one way that you could read the chicken being there is that it creates a sense of confusion that is useful for the point of sort of raising a certain amount of perhaps tension or mystery or just kind of instability as regards, you know, the way that the story is unfolding. There's something very strange and inscrutable about the chicken. But at the same time, it doesn't seem particularly important in terms of the plot. Right? It just sort of seems like this non-sequitur thing. But on an emotional level, I think that it is not entirely irrelevant. Did you want to?
Oh, I was just thinking the chicken is there, like, mostly to make it, like, weird,
yeah,
it just makes it weird. Like, imagine if you walk into a room and there's a caged chicken, like, regardless of the fact that there's bones on the ground and there's feathers everywhere, it's still weird.
Well, is a caged chicken weird? I don't know. I guess a caged chicken suspended from the ceiling,
that's kind of weird, like,
yeah. But there does seem to be a sort of strange, like pre-modern kind of like ancient, like, sacrificial quality to the presence of the chicken. Like, is the chicken, like, going to be a sacrifice? I think this is weird bone offer. There seems to be something very ritualistic about the way the bones are arrayed there. And the chicken kind of being cooped up in this way that's clearly not for eggs, you know, probably also not for any immediately useful purpose because of the way it's suspended at the top of the room. But there seems to be something operating on a, I suppose, irrational level or non-rational level, or as you say, just weird level. Emotionally, ritualistically, or otherwise, that does seem to be communicated by the presence of the chicken, but it's also kind of hilarious in a way that doesn't make you laugh outright and maybe it makes you feel a little bit uncomfortable.
It kind of, from her point of view, I would think that she would think this is like the word that comes to mind is barbaric.
Mm.
Like, the chicken and cult and sacrifice and like this like altar of bones and stuff like that. I don't know. It just like gives like a very, very like old timey.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean when I said pre-modern. You know, another way of describing that perhaps more neutrally is to say that the room is arrayed in a very intentional way. It's very clearly the bones aren't just scattered on the floor. There's this altar. The chicken isn't just wandering around aimlessly. It's in a small cage, a cage that was chosen precisely to fit a chicken and only a chicken. It's put at the top of the room instead of just kind of thrown in the corner. Right? So there's a very strong sense of intentionality, the purpose of which is completely obscure. Right? And so this is one of the things that helps to make it seem weird and ritualistic that, yeah, somebody went through a lot of trouble to do this, but why? There seems to be something very bizarre about that. And so that's one of the things that perhaps the chicken is communicating now that we see it in this particular situation.
It's also an indicator of how much time has passed since that was all set up. Is it just
I think
it's also kind of an indicator of how much time has passed since that was all set up, because the chicken's alive and able and hardy. It's not like dying.
That's true. Although there's a bunch of chicken feathers on the floor. So it's a little unclear if those are all from that chicken having lived there for, you know, it could be that somebody's feeding the chicken. We're spending a lot of time talking about the inner life of the chicken, but it's good. But you're right. I mean, perhaps, although that even there, if you really look into the way that the mise-en-scene works here in that room, there are a lot of details that are not clear at all. Like, what's with all the chicken feathers? Is it that there's like a continual sacrifice of a chicken, you know, and those are all just the feathers of the old, you know, the other chickens? Is it that the chicken has been there for a long time? And yet at the same time, there are elements of chaos in the room, but there are also elements of very clear intentionality and design, which makes it perhaps a little bit unseemly. All right, so we'll take a 3-minute break, and then we'll continue on with the lecture. We'll talk about the structure and techniques of film music next. So, I think I'm going to go out here and cool off.
Did you?
Oh, yeah, I got the headset. They're right there on the piano. Not on the music rack, but on the side there.
Okay, and so you choose from...
Yeah, you can just choose. Load up my lecture stuff here. What time is it?
8:05.
Okay, let's get started perhaps. There's a lot of material to get through. Okay. So, now we've spent a good amount of time looking at the relationship of sound in general and images. We've talked a little bit about the various aspects or dimensions, both of the visual layer and also the sonic layer, the three sort of pillars or the three layers of sound design, music, and dialogue. For the rest of the lecture today, what I would like to start talking about is some of the structures that take place in film music, Most of the elements of film music actually come out of classical music of the 19th century. So most of the things that I'm going to be talking about today are drawn from the aesthetics of classical music, particularly music from the end of the 18th century through the beginning of the 20th century. But before I do that, I would like to play a brief piece of music. Maybe we'll just listen to a minute or so of this piece. I should probably turn this off so you can't see the title. Yeah. Okay. So, raise your hand high and proud if you have not taken any music classes before. I can't remember who.
At UW?
At all.
Oh.
I like how disappointed you were. I couldn't remember who had a background in classical music or not. Anybody not have a background in classical music? It's not that important. Just for sake of me remembering what our points of reference are. Good. Well, anyway, even for those of you who may not have any background or knowledge of the history of classical music or the music theory, has anybody taken music theory classes before? Yeah. What classes did you take?
I just did like the levels with music theory. Like I took the tests.
The level you?
Yeah.
You mean like AP classes or do you?
No. Just like in my studio, we had music theory classes and we had to take tests.
Oh, I see.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
Good. Well, so a few of you have taken some music theory. This is actually, since this is a smaller group, it turns out that this is probably the most musically knowledgeable group I've had in this class, also because we have two music students in the back, which is kind of interesting. But even if you don't have any background in music, it turns out if you listen closely, you'll find that you know a lot more about any given piece of music than you might think. So I'd like to play about a minute or so of music, maybe 45 seconds or so, and I want you to tell me why you think this piece of music was written, the conditions under which it was probably first performed, who it might have been written for, perhaps when it was written. And then we're going to start to ask how we know these things. If you remember, yesterday Daniel mentioned that the helicopter music in Apocalypse Now sounds heroic, but there's a very interesting question of how do you know that it sounds heroic? So we'll discuss this a little bit now, but I want to start with this example. Circumstances. Under what circumstances do you think this piece was written? Why do you think it was written? Who was it written for? Jason.
Yeah. I would guess it's for some kind of march or like some event that would happen for like a royal.
Okay, so it sounds royal.
Yeah.
How do you know it sounds royal? What about it? Why do you think it sounds royal?
It sounds very brassy, punchy.
Mm-hmm.
Walking pace.
Okay, so it's a slow pace, which means that there's something perhaps refined about it. It's not like really fast. It doesn't sound like a battle or something like that. There's something very refined about it, and you know that because it's a slow pace. What are some other possibilities? Penny, what do you hear? Why do you think this music was written?
This is Handel.
Yeah, this is Handel.
This is the World of Flowers.
Yes. So.
So
what about the piece seems to be appropriate for that?
The strong drums.
Okay.
Why
are the strong drums appropriate though?
Well, they would punctuate the bursts of fireworks.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, perhaps. I don't think that maybe. It seems to me that if we didn't know that it was particularly written for the fireworks celebration, we'd still know that it sounds like a celebration or like a ceremony of some sort,
yeah.
Right?
There's a lot of weight.
There's a lot of weight. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So One thing we know is that it's a big ensemble playing, right? Which means that, you know, it requires a certain amount of wealth to put that sort of thing together. Usually people notice that it seems to have some sort of military quality, perhaps, because of the drum, right? And it turns out also the brass. I mean, those are the two traditional battlefield instruments. You have drums and brass. But of course, it's not really music for the battlefield. It's very stylized. There's something about it that's very stylized. And we know it's very stylized, one, because of the very, in a way, it's very complex rhythms, or very refined rhythms. It's not like, you know, some bugle playing ba 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 ba. It's bum, ba da. There's a sense of weight and grandiosity. That's one of the elements of stylization. There's another reason that we know that it's not battlefield music, because it's not just brass and drums, right? There are also strings playing, okay? So, now we have a situation in which it must therefore necessarily be a ceremony, because it has these military connotations, but it's not actually military music. It's not utilitarian military music. It's stylized military music. And the fact, whenever you have a notion of military rigor and discipline and so on, but that does not have any immediate function that is stylized, the only real situation I can think of is mainly a ceremony. So we know right off the bat that it's ceremonial. If you just think about what the instruments are that are being used, the style, the sort of weight to the music, that's also one of the things that makes it seem very clearly identifiable as perhaps royal music. There seems to be something very grand about it. Most of us would probably say that it sounds like a fanfare, right? So these are all things that are encoded in the music. The notion of it being a fanfare is encoded in the rhythms, because it's these slow, heavy, but also irregular rhythms. It's not like bom, 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 bom. It's bom, ba-da. But those are things that we always associate with a fanfare, and for various reasons, I mean, there's a sense of grandiosity associated with them. But we know that it's a fanfare precisely because of the way that fanfares tend to function. Fanfares are generally ceremonial military displays. They're used for ceremonial military displays. And the music is appropriate for that, because of the choice of instruments, because of the rhythms, because of the sense of stylization. So this is one of the things that we often encounter when we're dealing with film music, this notion of appropriate styles for a given scene or a given character. Let me load up my presentation here now. This notion of a musical style topic, this idea that there's certain ways in which messages can be encoded in music, and it's really mostly just because there are certain types of music, certain styles of music that we either normally encounter in particular situations or we associate with particular situations. We may not have ever been to a royal ceremony, but we nonetheless associate fanfares with royal ceremonies. And so there's, in a sense, a sort of level of meaning that a piece of music can articulate just by virtue of association, by using elements that are typically associated with a given style. In this case, it's a fanfare style, but there are many other styles of music that might bring forth certain associations. Now, we don't know anything necessarily about the way that that melody develops, if there are any particular characters that are associated with that melody, but nonetheless, we might be able to imagine scenes in a movie that would be appropriate for this kind of music, and scenes in which there would be a sort of sense, a relationship of tension between this kind of music and whatever is happening in the story or the scene. But the tension would arise from us having a certain association with this kind of music, and yet encountering the music and our associations in a situation that was contrary to those associations. So, like, for instance, if if you've ever seen the movie Trading Places, for instance, where Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy are like homeless and then they get rich or something like that. If you had this music combined with somebody who was kind of just wallowing around in a gutter, right, you would have a sense that there is a certain amount of tension in the scene. But you know that precisely because of the coded associations that the music has as an element in a sort of culture, our cultural association with this sort of music. Whenever you encounter music that seems to be alluding to a particular style that has all sorts of social or perhaps economic or political associations, the term that, at least since the 1980s, that has been used to describe that is in terms of a musical topic. So, for instance, here we have a fanfare topic, right? So you would say that this piece of music seems to be communicating a certain number of things precisely because of the associations that it calls forth as a result of the style that the music is written in. Now, the other thing that we see happen in film scores quite a lot, although it starts to disappear, I suppose, around the 1960s, but it's still quite prevalent, is the idea of leitmotif. Some of you may have encountered the notion of leitmotif before. It is a technique that was more or less developed and pioneered by Richard Wagner. But basically, what a leitmotif is a specific melody that is associated with a character and might, for instance, develop in a certain way if something interesting happens to the character, right? So, for instance, if we have a love theme that is associated with me as a character and the object of my desire turns me down, then the movie might play the love theme, but it might be really dark and gloomy or something. But it might be the same melody, just harmonized in a different way or with slight changes to perhaps communicate some of the inner emotional world of the character. The idea, though, is that there are two different things. One, the musical style topic, it doesn't really matter what the melody is. It's not a specific melody that you hum and think, oh, you know, that's the Star Wars theme, or that's the Force theme, or that's Darth Vader's theme, or that's the Rebel theme. Rather, it's just some kind of style. So, for instance, many of you probably, if you hadn't heard the piece that I just played a moment ago, you probably all recognize that it's a fanfare, and yet many of you might not even be able to sing it back to me, right? This is the difference between the style and the actual melody as a leitmotif. These are different things, and they're used, sometimes they're used together, but not necessarily so. Quite often, leitmotifs are based on styles, specific styles, so that, for instance, we'll look at some excerpts from Star Wars. The Imperial March, for instance, is a specific theme. Da 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 da. Everybody knows that melody, right? And it's a melody that comes back all over the place. But the way it's usually presented is in the particular style of a march. So the idea is that the leitmotif, usually the way that we encounter it is as a march. But what we're going to do is see a scene from Return of the Jedi where the melody of the Imperial March is presented in a way that's not in the style of the march, and it seems to be communicating something about what's happening in the scene. So let's look at this now. This is, I'm sorry, here's the, well, that's not it. I have it on the website. Maybe I'll just play it from the website. Oh, you saw it here? I didn't. Oh, yeah, I think that's it. But then, still, I have them all laid out really nice and sequentially on the website, so I'll just play them from here. Yeah, here we go. Okay. All right, so, you know, since some of you may not have seen Star Wars, you might not know about this scene, but I'll play the original Force, not the Force theme, the original Imperial March, as it appears in The Empire Strikes Back. And then We'll look at how it's used in The Return of the Jedi as a leitmotif, and what it how it seems to be changed, developed, perhaps, and how it seems to, in some sense, be responding to what's happening in the scene. So here's the original. Now, there are a few things about that. It's certainly obviously a march. And in fact, you know, there's something about the Royal Fireworks music that's also sort of march-like. It's probably a little too slow for it to be a true march. But there is already something in the way that the music is put together, the style, that seems to be communicating something about the characters that it's associated with, right? For one thing, the harmony is very strange. If you remember the harmony from the Royal Fireworks music, this sort of nice big celebration, it has very stable harmonies, a very clear sense of a tonal center. It's it's very clear what the tonic is. However, the Imperial March does this sort of strange thing where it's moving in between different keys. Harmonized with a chord that is in a different key, basically, which makes it seem really weird and not happy at all. It seems kind of evil because it's not stable. It's not perhaps as celebratory for that reason. But now let's look at the way it's used in other parts of the series. And now we're going to look at it now not so much as being in the style of a march, namely a march topic. We're going to look at it as a specific melody that's used in specific circumstances and developed, changed, altered, varied in various ways that seem to communicate something about perhaps the inner world of the characters or something about the narrative of the film.
Luke, help me too. This much more.
Too far.
Nothing can stop that now. Just the lights. Let me look on you with my own eyes.
Pointed out a couple moments that the Imperial March theme, now used as a leitmotif, comes down. How is it altered? Well, sort of. The harp is involved, but the harp's not playing the melody. The harp's playing like glissandos and that kind of thing. Yeah. Let's see. My random oracle tells me that Jet should hazard a guess here. Have you seen Star Wars movies? Have you seen Star Wars before?
A while ago. I mean, it's been decades, maybe.
Yeah. So. Did you hear the melody when I pointed it out?
I did. I don't have too many thoughts on it.
You do or you don't have too many
thoughts? I don't know what to say about it.
Uh-huh. Well, you can certainly say how it's different from the first time I played with all the spaceships. Right? Yeah, maybe think about it a little bit more. Jason.
I can't recall like the melodies that specifically came with this.
All right, well, you guys are going to want to. All right, I'll stop with the awkward and imperious men calling names and go to people who'd like to answer. Yeah, go ahead.
It's they do it with higher strings, and they also do it in a major key. And
there are two times that you get the note. Right around the time, I think it's slightly before they take the mask off, you get the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, not much slower, and in high strings. Also, if you listen very closely, there is no harmony involved. The way that I played it from the original version of all the spaceships, there is a bunch of harmony. The fact that the different chords that harmonize the melody are taken from different keys, so it sounds really weird and unstable and kind of evil, perhaps. And now what we have is it just being played in very, very high strings, and now there's no harmony on the melody, it's just the melody itself. So why would the gentleman decide to do that? What does that seem to be communicating about what's going on in the film at this point? Yeah, Dan.
Well, in the first scene, it's really representing sort of like the grandeur and the awe and the might of the empire.
Yeah.
But this is, you know, in the plot of the film, after Vader is defeated, after the Emperor is defeated, so it's already kind of crumbling, and it's so it's more.
It's more frail, perhaps.
But it's also, I mean. You still have that link, that association with Vader.
Well, because it's his melody. It's his song, so
right.
to speak. Right? But,
now, but it's more sentimental.
Yeah, it's it's certainly more frail. I think you don't even need to know anything about the story to see the connection. You have these very ghostly sounding, very frail, fragile, high strings, and you see an old man dying. I think it's pretty clear that there's a very obvious sense of fragility, of frailness, of even ghostliness, perhaps, in the way that it's orchestrated and now not harmonized. And the harmony also gives it more sense of force now with the fact that it's just a solo melodic line makes it seem perhaps more empty in a way, right? So this is one of the ways. Now, one of the things that's very interesting about the Imperial March thing, Alec mentioned that the next time we get it, with it's a flute and the harp is accompanying. So first of all, it's harp and flute instead of brass, right? And the harp and the flute tend to have a sort of bucolic, ancient pastoral connotation, right? So there seems to be something that is in tension with the notion of Darth Vader as this cyborg dictator or whatever, that is sort of hinting at this Arcadian past, Arcadian just meaning this sense of our past when we had a more direct connection to nature, sort of Garden of Eden sort of thing, the flute and the harp perhaps calling those sorts of nature scenes to mind. And perhaps there's something sentimental, this idea of a past life that Darth Vader might have had. But what's very interesting about the melody itself, and one of the ways that it functions as a leitmotif is also one of the things I've said is when the flute's playing, it sounds like it's in a major key. But it turns out that the melody itself is just a major triad. That's in the armor of these heavy minor chords, right? And now that Darth Vader is being dead, has been defeated and is dying, and he comes out of the armor, we have now the melody presented without any harmony, and it's revealed that it's a major key. It's a major chord instead of a minor chord, which is actually kind of interesting in a way. So this is the way that a composer might, in a sense, one, use style topics, use certain styles to communicate information about the characters. Namely, we get the style of a march, a very heavy march, when the Empire is in full force, and Empire Strikes Back, when the Empire is defeated and Darth Vader is being separated from his cyborg armor. Now what we see is that the melody, it doesn't exactly develop, but its identity is shown, that it's actually just a major chord that all the time have been presented in these with these minor chord harmonizations, but the melody itself outlines a major chord. So it's sort of like a composer using musical materials and musical techniques to convey something about the characters and stories that, as it unfolds. This is the essence of what leitmotif does as a technique. It's a way of developing melodies that you associate with certain characters, such that the developments, the variations on the melody, either in orchestration, in harmony, in, you could have melodic elaborations, these sorts of things, somehow seem to be communicating something about the inner life of the character, the sense of fragility, perhaps, that these characters are experiencing. It might communicate something about the way that the story is unfolding. One of the things we'll see, one of the things that Wagner does very well, is create this sort of two levels of storyline that happen simultaneously. And you can kind of think of it as, in Freudian terms, as the ego, which is really the story as it's happening on stage with the characters interacting. And then there's like the id or the subconscious or this sort of repressed level of narrative that happens musically. So as the characters, they might be singing something like, I love you, you're the object of my desire. But at the same time, what they're singing might be the motive that's associated with death or with, some other kind of dark emotion. So in the light of day on stage, what they're saying is, I love you. But musically, sort of in this other sort of id level or subconscious level of meaning, the music that they're singing is associated throughout the opera with death. And you see exactly that happening in movies like Vertigo, where the music seems to be functioning as a separate sort of subconscious narrative that's happening beneath the conscious narrative that you actually see on screen. That's a very interesting way of using music in narrative. In Alexander Nevsky, the movie we're going to watch tomorrow, Prokofiev uses leitmotif extensively. He uses it in a way that's a little bit more obvious. It's more in line with the way that John Williams is using it. He really wants the audience to kind of get the relationship of the music and the characters. And I think you'll see many cases of how certain melodies that are associated with the different characters are developed and altered in various ways, made more dissonant or made more perhaps unstable harmonically. So for instance, in the movie, you get this sort of fanfare thing happening a lot. The story these invading German crusaders that are waging war against Russian tribes. And the melody that is associated with the German crusaders goes like this. It's a, but what do you think it would mean if the melody were at some point not presented like that, but presented like this? What's the difference between those two melodies, and what might that mean for the development of the story? You have one that's very grandiose and heavy and very, you know, sort of self-serving. So what would the second of those options be? The one that seems sort of constrained and perhaps more dissonant, what would that seem to be communicating about the possible direction that the story might be taking? Nobody has any idea? Irene.
You're running out of luck or something.
Yeah, there's something very feeble about it, right? There's something very stable and consonant and grounded harmonically. It's not dissonant, it's very consonant, it's very clear what the tonic is when I do. That sounds like a central pitch, a thin pitch. When I played it in a more dissonant, more harmonically ambiguous way, it's a lot less certain about itself. And you'll see that Prokofiev does exactly that sort of thing. In a way, it's sort of, you know, like in Tom and Jerry, it's a term which sometimes is referred to as Mickey Mousing, right, where you very obviously try to match what's happening visually with music. So if you think about, like, Tom and Jerry, the way it works, it's like, you know, somebody's tiptoeing and you've got a bunch of strings being plucked in rhythm with the tiptoeing. That's known as Mickey Mousing. And there's a sort of sense in Mickey Mousing that's happening with the Prokofiev soundtrack in Alexander Nevsky, which you see. But the basic idea is that it's functioning through the use of leitmotif, and that the specific melodies that might have certain style motifs, right, so clearly a march, clearly a fanfare, and it has that sort of meaning, but when a fanfare is presented not in the sense of stability and consonance and certainty, but it's presented in terms of dissonance, harmonic ambiguity, maybe rhythmic, you know, jankiness or something, just rhythmic ambiguity. There are various ways that a composer could use musical materials to shape the leitmotif or the style topic so that it seems like there's something perhaps wrong with it, or perhaps is enhanced in one way or another. Good. So, let's move on now. We have a few minutes left to talk about some of the visual things that were pioneered by the director of the film, Sergei Eisenstein. We won't worry about absolute music and I think I'll probably save this. Well, no, I think I could. Yeah, let's start with mechanized art. And I'll talk a little bit about some of the ideas behind the technique that was pioneered by Sergei Eisenstein, the director of the movie we'll watch tomorrow. Namely, his series of montage. And by the way, you have a reading that you're going to need to do. It might be good to do it tonight, so that you, or tomorrow before class, so that you have it in mind before watching the movie, and see how his statements and his intentions as an artist and as a, in a sense, sort of artistic philosopher stack up against what he actually does in the movie. Because one of the things you'll see is that he doesn't really do what he seems to be arguing for in the reading that you have, and it would be sort of interesting to look at why the movie that his, in fact, his first sound film, Alexander Nevsky, all the other films that he created were silent films before that point. So the reading that you have is the Statement on Sound, which was written together with a few other Soviet directors. And basically the thing that he calls for is, he talks about it in terms of audio-visual montage. So we'll have to understand, first of all, what the ideas are behind montage visually, and then come to a sense of what it means when it's combined with sound. So, one of the things about film which makes it quite different from all the other art forms that had come before it is the fact that it relies very heavily on a mechanical apparatus. You think about painting, you think about music, I suppose you could say that musical instruments are mechanical to a certain degree, but most music from the 18th century was based on the model of vocal music. Painting has a certain amount of apparatus, you need brushes and these sorts of things, but for the most part, they're not mechanized. There's very little automation or anything like that. And in particular, the approach to the art form, I think, becomes very highly influenced by the fact that it is a very mechanical way of producing art. Mechanical because of the use of machines like the camera, machines that will allow directors to cut the film in various ways, in very precise ways. And it makes it, in a way, quite different. It's in a way, a very large and salient break from the sorts of approaches to art that came before it. Now, there's the mechanized element of it, which is important, but the other thing about film, which is quite different from visual arts before film, is that it, in a way, injects reality into an artwork. Now, think about what that means. If you take, basically, a painting, for instance, there's always a very strong sense of separation between the painting, the objects that are in the painting, and the real world. There seems to be a sort of aesthetic separation that we're talking, for instance, about the difference between real battlefield music, horn calls and so on to communicate on the battlefield, versus the stylized sort of distance version of it as a piece of classical music. There always tends to be in art before the 20th century a sort of rarefied space that is separate from the everyday world of reality. But what film does is inject reality directly into the artwork. And it does that through the use of photographic images. Now, instead of images being stylized, representational, representations of things, they are literally real photographs of I guess, in a sense, our everyday material reality. Now, it had been the case before. Here I've written up reality, representation, abstraction. Around the end of the 19th century, you have a number of painters that are trying to move beyond the limitations, as they see it anyway, the limitations of always having to paint things that people recognize as being a horse or a mountain or a car. In particular, the artist Vasily Kandinsky wants to create an approach to painting that, in some sense, captures the essence of music. Now, if you think about what that means, most of you have a background in some classical music, so you probably are all familiar with Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, right? Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, in a sense, has a storyline. I mean, you have a theme that develops, you have these sort of climaxes of music, you have moments where you expect something to happen, like you expect to return to the main theme, but instead of returning to the main theme, Beethoven goes in some other direction and only comes to the theme later. So you have these elements of narrative, expectation, surprise, development, linearity. But if I were to ask you, okay, so what is Beethoven's Fifth Symphony about? Pretty much everybody would say, well, it isn't about anything exactly. I mean, there's very strong sense of meaningfulness, of a sort of meaningful interaction of things, a sense of direction, a sense of build-up, climax, denouement, resolution, these sorts of things. But it isn't actually about anything in particular. In a sense, it's just abstract narrative. It's sort of like the abstract elements of narrative without any particular characters, without any particular places, without any sort of concrete dialogue or anything like that. And what Kandinsky was trying to do was find an approach to painting, to visual art, that had that same sort of abstract expressivity to it. Now, the thing about Kandinsky, so we see here three pictures from Kandinsky as he moves towards abstraction. And first you have a man on a horse, it's pretty clearly representational. Then there's this very, very stylized thing going on here, which you can still kind of see a horse here and a man on a horse, but it seems quite stylized and, you know, sort of abstract. And then the third image here, there really isn't any recognizable object at all. It's just the formal relations of colors, the formal relations of shapes and these sorts of things on the canvas. And this is what he means when he talks about getting to the essence of music in painting, that there is this sort of sense that it coheres, it kind of makes sense, it's in a way sort of beautiful in the use of color, but it's not actually representational of anything. Well, that is to say, it's not figurative of anything, but it's not reality either. So in the case of painting, you always had either figurative painting, where you're literally drawing a horse, or you had this sort of abstract painting, but in either case, it's a representation of some sort. It's not really reality. It's not really photographic images. It's not really about the real world. There's always this element of stylization about it. And many artists became sort of fed up with that around the end of the 19th century because, in a sense, there developed this idea that art, basically, in order to really be taken seriously as art, it needs to, in a sense, only worry about its own concerns. That is to say, you see this all the time, for instance, on Facebook, when there's an article about how if you take music lessons, it helps your mathematical aptitudes. And invariably, there's always somebody who writes in and says, but that's not what makes music valuable. What makes music valuable is not that it helps your social interactions. It's not that it makes you, you know, have better spatial or mathematical aptitude. It's somehow valuable just for its own sake. And this is the idea that comes out of 19th century art and aesthetics and music, that what makes art valuable is the fact that it doesn't have any material use. It's just sort of purely valuable because of the enjoyment it gives or because of the way that it shows formal interaction. But there isn't any specific use for it, and that's what makes it great. And in fact, the way that artists would talk about this is that art is, to experience a work of art on its own terms is a situation in which you can be most free. Because now you're not, the work of art is enjoyable, but it's not enjoyable because it fills your belly or it fulfills some material concern. It just, in a way, allows you to have the sort of highest experience that is available to humanity, this sort of abstract, purely aesthetic experience. Now, you can imagine that a lot of artists might not like that idea very much, because for a variety of reasons. I mean, for one thing, most artists don't want to necessarily be completely cut off from the rest of the world. They want to have art that matters, art that means something. But there are other political implications of this, because if in particular, since we're talking about Soviet filmmakers who were very highly influenced by, both directly by Marx, but then also by certain interpretations of Marx, say Lenin's interpretation of Marx. What they saw was the problem that Marx put this way. Marx was talking about philosophy. He says that up until my time, philosophy was always only interested in understanding the world. But he says the true purpose of philosophy is to change the world, to actually make the world a better place. And artists had the same sort of situation where they thought that it wasn't enough to just sort of have this abstract, you know, sort of non-material enjoyment. They wanted their art to be capable of changing the world. And so one of the things that they felt that they had to do in order to make that possible was essentially to puncture the aesthetic veil, to puncture that sense of distance that you typically have to a figurative artwork. And so, by and large, what many artists did was to start injecting reality, fragments of reality, into their artworks. In the case of film, I think that's quite obvious because we're dealing with photographic images. If you know anything about the playwright Bertolt Brecht, who's also a Marxist playwright, one of the things that he would do is break the fourth wall, which is another aesthetic veil. Basically, the fourth wall is when you're walking a play and you see these people, these other human beings, in the same room as you, and yet somehow there's this distance where they don't acknowledge your presence. And in a certain sense, you don't acknowledge them as being part of your own actual reality. And so what he would do is have a lot of direct address where the narrative of the play would suddenly stop and the characters would start talking to the audience. And you see that sometimes in film these days as well. But in the case of the play, there can actually be even more interaction between the actors and the people. But the idea is that, in a sense, what these artists are doing by bringing the real world into the artwork is creating a situation in which art can directly address the world, our own material reality, in a variety of ways. Now, Eisenstein is interested in this, and, well, here's one last example, a Picasso collage. Now, instead of it just being painting and drawings, you actually have actual scraps of newspaper and other found objects that are glued onto the canvas together with the painting and the drawing, another example of reality being injected into the artwork. So now we get to the idea of montage. Montage is a way of using actual images, let me say photographic filmic images, in a way that is very surprising. That is to say, in a way that makes us perhaps question our normal, uncritical understanding of the objects that we see. And typically what he does, if you go on, I'm not going to spend a lot of time playing examples in class. I have all the examples on the website, so you should go and look at, there's a video on the website called Eisenstein's five modes of montage, or five types of montage. But what he typically does is try to create a situation in which objects are put in very, sometimes very contrasting situations, so that we see these real objects, and yet their relationships, their juxtapositions, awaken a certain sort of perhaps understanding about the objects that we normally encounter, that we might not encounter in everyday life without the mediation of film. So for instance, one of the things he does is a movie called Strike, which is about these factory workers that go on strike. And the factory workers all get gunned down by government troops, the strike fails, and the bourgeoisie wins again, I suppose. But at the moment that the strikers are being shot down, it's intercut with images of a bull being slaughtered. And it's sort of interesting because, well, for one thing, there's something very disturbing about watching an actual bull being slaughtered instead of a painting of a bull being slaughtered. And that's one of the things that photographic images, now, when I say that it injects reality into the artwork, you might think, well, yeah, but it's still just a photograph. It's not actual reality. Yeah, but in the case of a bull being slaughtered, the bull was actually slaughtered in order for that to happen, right? And so we can see how reality is being brought in here in a very sort of striking and, you know, kind of disturbing way. But at the same time, what film makes possible is a juxtaposition between workers being gunned down and this very visceral, disturbing image of an actual bull being slaughtered. And these are not the sorts of things that you could normally see one after the other in everyday life. They're not the sort of thing that you could see in a play. It's only possible because of montage, the cutting of one scene and intercutting with another scene. And it's a way of, in a sense, using reality, putting reality into a series of relationships that draw out a certain meaning, draw out a certain comparison, or a certain understanding that is usually quite clear in the film, but is not the sort of thing that we would normally uncritically experience in our everyday lives. And so the idea here is that what Eisenstein wants to do is create a sort of filmmaking that in a way is very artificial. He wants to draw the viewer's attention very clearly to the fact that the images are mediated, that they're cut in a specific way, that images that seem not to necessarily have any immediate literal relationship to each other, nonetheless have perhaps an emotional relationship or a formal relationship. It might be that, for instance, in the case of the movie Psycho, right, where the woman stabbed in the shower, that there's a dissolve from her from the drain with her blood going into her eye. And it's a match because they're both circles and they're both in the same location on the screen. The drain and the eye don't necessarily have anything to do with each other. And yet when we see the blood, the sinew, sort of spiraling around the drain, I mean going down the drain literally, and then we see the eye of the dead woman, you can't help but make a comparison, but not a literal comparison, it's a formal comparison because the circle of the drain and the circle of the eye match in the film. So the idea here is that there is a way in which film can situate our own reality, that is, images, objects that we experience in our own reality, in a way that makes them unfamiliar to us. So that you see one image, but it's put in a relationship that makes you really think about the image that you're seeing in a very critical way. And the idea here is that Eisenstein is trying to use film basically as a way to, there's sort of a political motivation here, that he wants to use this sort of defamiliarization of reality, as you see it on the film, to act as a sort of analog to defamiliarization of our social reality. That is to say, all the various things in society, the values, the laws, the rules that we take for granted, that we can't imagine being any other way, that it might hopefully awaken us to some more critical position vis-a-vis our own everyday reality. Because we see now reality put up on the screen in this way that is, in a sense, very strange, defamiliarizing. And the hope, at least, that Eisenstein has is that we take that experience, that insight, and apply it to our own everyday reality. Where now, when I see a bull, maybe I'm driving down in the countryside, and otherwise I might have seen a bull and thought, oh, what a nice, beautiful countryside. Isn't it great that that bull has, you know, but I've just seen a bull slaughtered, and I've seen a connection between that and the proletariat being gunned down because they want slightly higher wages. That's a way in which putting these images, these fragments of reality together in this precise way in a film might make us aware of certain elements of our own social reality that we take for granted. So that seeing the bull now, you might not immediately necessarily think of the strikers being gunned down, you might. But another way to think about it is to sort of, that it might dispel this sort of fantasy of, you know, this bucolic paradise, because probably the bull is on a farm, and there's really only two reasons that the bull is on a farm: to impregnate cows and to turn into the hamburgers, basically, right? And so these are the sorts of ways in which the critical defamiliarization of reality fragments in a film might then awaken us to a more critical stance vis-a-vis our own socio-political, economic reality. Okay, so there are some examples of Eisenstein's montage technique from a variety of films. You should go online and view that, and do the reading, because, just quickly, what he says about film sound is it's great because it brings in another level of defamiliarization, that the ideal is to create a sort of tension between the sound and the images. And we'll have the question while we're watching the film, Alexander Nevsky, his first sound film, whether or not he actually does that, or if he seems to abandon those ideas and move in a different direction. All right, that's all for today. So, see you next time. By the way, the bull scene from Strike is, since we just had Apocalypse Now, Francis Ford Coppola makes an allusion to the bull in the end of Apocalypse Now. If you go and watch Apocalypse Now, there's a very specific allusion to Eisenstein and the slaughtering of the bull that's taken from the movie Strike. All right. See you.